Welcome, everybody. Delighted to have Jeffrey Tucker, the CEO and founder of the Brownstone Institute, and a regular, almost daily, I believe it is, Jeffrey, contributor to the Epoch Times. Also was a master of ceremonies, I'm going to add, to the Anarchapuka, many of Jeffrey, Jeff Berwick's events. It was nice to meet him then, and it's even better to meet him on a very shiny metal day for gold markets, as the gold futures hits 2040, and the silver markets with silver north of $25. Jeffrey, welcome. Glad to have you.
It's good to be here. In terms of these metal markets, everything old is new again. I don't know what else to say. I mean, this is the nightmare that had been predicted for many decades, I would say, since the early 1970s. And it's all coming together. And we're seeing the response exactly as the old theorists would have imagined. There's a flight to the real, loss of confidence in the banking system, a real sense that these central bankers have no idea what they're doing. They're making things up as they go along. And what can you really depend on? It really comes down to it. It's a flight to safety, right? And so I assume we're just at the beginning of a gigantic bull market. Now, what has changed since the early 1970s, of course, is the advent of decentralized cryptocurrency, the premier example of which is, of course, Bitcoin, which, you know, has gained 70 or more percent in the last 3 months. I forget now, I'd have to do the math on it, what it's been like since January 1, but it's been very impressive. So kudos to those people who saw that there was a buy opportunity last year, leaned in on it. They trusted their instincts over the quality of the technology, over the screaming of the media. So that adds to the safety element. And I should add that this is all taking place in a time where the attacks on crypto are stronger than ever from the regulatory state. And in light of the failure of a lot of proprietary exchanges and tokens over the last year or two. So these things have performed extremely well.
Yes, you're right on both accounts, actually. We've got Bitcoin in an inverted head and shoulder, which has an upside structure. Wait for it. We think 40K and the 42.5 neckline that was the beginning of the bear market side as its initial move before possibly resting, which is going to be in all likelihood, much like gold and silver, unlikely to pause there, but maybe have a bit of coiling up time as well. So Bitcoin is certainly really coming alive. We're seeing the dominance actually staying with Bitcoin. So people are going to stay with it, try it and test it. This feels like it's going back to what is the comfort of real money? Because we're getting gold be the initial runner, the god market for the metals. And we're going to be seeing, in our opinion, Bitcoin first ahead of any of the other alts, hoovering up a lot of the new money. And this is in the, what I'd call a hyper-stagflationary environment where actually the consumer's on a very low ebb. Jobs are cut, inflation is high, and oil is stubbornly sticking around pretty high as the Rockefeller tax that seems to always be skimming. Is this your feeling that it's going to be the security play is away from fiat? And this is a very long-winded question, but touch past Brazil and China and the trading in real and yuan and the de-dollarization and lesser lights like Kenyan presidents having a stab at the end of the dollar and a lot of dollar FUD. It's finally like the FUD has moved from the Bitcoin markets into the dollar world, and the dollar's not holding up so great.
I just assume that de-dollarization is a very long way off, which is not the same thing as saying that the collapse of the American empire is far off. I think it probably has already happened. I mean, when you're talking about a trade and currency relationship between India, Russia, Saudi Arabia, China, and Brazil, I would have to kind of like do the math on what percentage of the world population that is, but that at some point, this is the U.S. is not a going concern anymore in the world. So, I mean, it's actually a surprising time. I mean, it's, you know, as Mao said, these are interesting times. I mean, for anybody alive right now, we're really seeing the chapter close on the American empire the same way it closed on Britain, on Spain, on Portugal, and on the Aztecs. You can go back in history, but every empire has its day, and that's what I've concluded from the events of the last week.
Yeah, that's seminal, almost, as in terms of the week. I was also thinking of, you know, Biden's reception by the Saudis and then the subsequent reception for Xi and Putin and the contrast in that. There's been a lot of following, particularly the Afghanistan withdrawal. It does seem that the sanctions clearly backfired. That's probably got to go down as one of the biggest political errors, which involved the seizure of the Russian money. That seems to have actually accelerated this process. But the Biden administration seems to be the perfect drug for the acceleration of bad management and the acceleration of decline of empire and dollar hegemony.
Yeah, it's remarkable, too, to watch the power of economics over the power of military, right? So the U.S. is still occupying the entire world, but actually nobody cares anymore. I mean, like, what it really comes down to it, finance, is trumping everything else. And the U.S. is going to continue to maintain its silly empire all over the world, you know, troops in I don't know how many countries, 100-something. But it really doesn't matter. And it's not enough, you know, to have bases stationed around the world. You can't force people to use a currency that they don't want to use. I mean, the U.S. has been discredited. And it's remarkable to think how these events unfolded, because let's just talk briefly about the Trump administration, because people credit the Trump administration for not going to war, and that was a good thing. And the sort of America first policy was very good. In a trade sense, it was very bad, because he pulled out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership and was like, screw you people, we don't need you. Well, we probably didn't need them. Actually, that was probably a huge error. And then, you know, annoying every trade partner in the world with taxes on his own people, you know, at the expense of smooth trade relationships. And I would include in there China. I think that was a huge error. And certainly the Biden administration's deal with Russia was catastrophic. But I mean, think back to 2018, look at all the people, or 2017, really, and 18. It was more like started January 18. It was Canada. It was Germany. It was Mexico. I mean, you went through the list of every country with whom the U.S. was running a trade deficit, and Trump just, you know, took his red pen and drew through it and said, 5%, 10%, 15%, 20%. And if they retaliate, make it 25% and 30%, and so on it went. Well, that shattered U.S. clout around the world, because it just seemed to many countries the U.S. is a very bad actor. So on one hand, it's great that we didn't get into new wars. On the other hand, we got into a lot of trade wars. And now the U.S. finds itself completely isolated. We forced many countries in the world to look elsewhere, because the trust in the U.S. as a regime was dismantled in that period. So ironically, even though Trump really sort of believes in a world dominated by America, he actually relinquished American power all over the world, and then, of course, with the lockdowns, that just made everything worse. So it's actually one of the great ironies of history that you could say that the decline and fall of the U.S. empire around the world, economically and otherwise, politically and culturally, probably culturally also. Really did begin in the last 4 years, or at least accelerated to the point that it became historically significant.
Yeah, and unfortunately irreversible. And I want to highlight, this is not an anti-American rant. As a people, when I go, love Americans and all of that, but unfortunately, the people on top that are, and the agenda that they've pursued, the war is peace, and some of the doctrines, and the dominance, they're not going to be missed. And there's going to be a lot of people that are going to project that on the citizens, sadly and incorrectly. But I'm not looking forward to China being a far more dominant force and having to to kowtow to some of their diktats, of course, the credit score and everything else. Where is America? A couple of the questions when we tweeted out, we're having you on board. Where is America in 2030 was one of them. What do you see? Just do a sketch.
I think America in 2030 is Britain in 1921. A people, proud people with a vast international reach, but had lost its power. And I don't know where that leaves us domestically. Internationally, I'm pretty sure that it's just straight down. Domestically, I'm very worried because we're returning in this country to sort of pre-modern forms of politics. The machinery of the state these days is used entirely for purposes of punishing enemies and rewarding friends. Like, we've given up the sort of constitutional ideals. I mean, that it seemed not to matter anymore. It's very interesting to me because I have a lot of friends in Congress and in the Senate and people working for the minute. A lot of people on the sort of rebellious side that are saying, well, we need justice, we need to stop this tax censorship, we need to stop, you know, the inflation. They have good motivations. I'm just not optimistic that there's any coming back from this at this point. So Americans are financially far more panicked than you read about. And you can see it in the data. You know, whether it's the decline in real income, the increase of credit card debt, houses are starting to be underwater. People are panicking about where to put the money, the stability of the banking system. Like, everybody is. And also, I think earlier you mentioned something about job losses. These job losses deserve some extra commentary because they're mainly focused in management, high-end management fields that became ridiculously overblown and puffy and pointless over the 15 years of 0% interest rates, which are heavily subsidized. Things on the right side of the yield curve. So, you know, we got, you know, big tech and big media and big everything. And anybody with a credential was able to earn, you know, pull down six-figure salaries and then Zoom from home, right? So those days seem to be ending. I mean, just a couple of days ago, McDonald's shut down its corporate headquarters to restructure. Well, we know they're not going to be firing fry cooks and hamburger people and dishwashers. I mean, that's not the people that they're going to be fired. It's all in the management structure. So we're seeing a kind of euthanasia of the overclass that's taking place in 2023, and it's only going to accelerate. We've just begun. I'm telling you, when Elon Musk, fired whatever it was, 7 out of 10 employees, actually probably more, 4 out of 5 employees, and the company became better than ever, that did not go unnoticed in the whole of the corporate sector in the West. So that model is the future. So this is a time to kind of regroup for people. I mean, and the other thing is that it means a downgrading of social status for millions upon millions of people, which is a very painful process to go through. But that is the trauma of this generation.
I think so. A cutting of the fluff, as you mentioned. And as you say, it's more of the bourgeois money, the middle and the middle upper class that are now going to start to feel the heat, because the working poor have continually felt that. They've had the fat trimmed off them so regularly with every recession that they're pretty down to the essentials. And Elon Musk being part of that AI generation very much in terms of Neuralink relationship and all of that. He came and you're kind of right. He's almost like the flag flyer for this business can function on far less people. There's too many content filterers and moderators. It's time we just cut it back. Right.
And management layers, right? I mean, like, you know, everybody knows. It's so funny because everybody knows this, right? I mean, like, so your typical corporate employee in the United States is constantly scandalized at how many layers and layers and layers of people they have that are serving absolutely no purpose other than to schedule meetings and attend them, right? And we all know this, and we've all wondered, at what point is economics going to start catching up? And, well, that point is now, and it's just going to intensify. We are facing labor markets like we've never seen before. There is a massive shortage of workers in hospitality and retail and a huge surplus and upper management and the like, and professionals.
Middle management in tech that aren't actively programming, but they're sort of vague project managers. I'll read this list out to you, Jeffrey. I retweeted this morning. Largest layoffs of 2023 so far. Amazon, 27,000 employees at number one. Google, 12,000. Meta, 10,000. Microsoft, 10,000. 10,000 is a lot of people. You think about how many families that is. Why add a couple of kids and wives on that? Goldman Sachs, 3,200. Coinbase, 25%. Zoom, 15%. Glassdoor, 15. Twilio, 15. Indeed, Lending Club, Vimeo, DocuSign, Salesforce, and Gemini, all 10 to 15%. 15% layoffs. And I'm gonna stick my neck out and say they're going to do a second or third round in that, and they're going to find a little bit more before this whole game is over.
They're going about it slowly because they don't always know where to cut. It's actually a very difficult thing to know. And the remarkable thing about Elon is that he faced an emergency situation. He had to cut back labor costs dramatically or else go bankrupt, right? So he just began to take a bit of buzzsaw just randomly all around the office. And it turns out people learn skills they didn't have before, and they get by, and you know, they rely on whatever kind of people are around there. And so these companies can adapt even to seemingly bizarre. They're trying to cut in a rational way. There may not be a rational way to do it, especially since you start interviewing people at these companies. It's like, how essential is your job? Oh, it's very essential. It's like that movie Office Space. It's like, what do you say you do here?
What is it exactly that you do? Yeah. Yeah, that's a great moment. Yeah, that way I attend meetings and organize meetings, as you were saying. Yeah, fascinating. So that surely is going to be such a downdraft on property. So we've had 6 or 7 months now of negative property prices. Don't forget, the equity market and the bond market has come off the worst performance combined since 17 god knows what. I think it was 1768. So you've got people shunning debt. You've got China dumping treasuries. So they are at one of their lowest ebbs on treasuries and continuing to distribute that. And the central banks and the emerging nations are the biggest buyers of gold and silver. So instead of stacking up on dollars to fight their dollar-based debt, they're almost going, we're going straight to the gold. So, I mean,
yeah, there's a lack of confidence in the Federal Reserve at this point. And part of the problem is that after the largest and fastest rate increases basically on record that we ever have, the 10-year treasuries are still at negative 2%. So what that is...
In real terms, you're talking about, just for those listening,
In real terms, which, by the way, the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis does not distribute these interest rates in real terms. You have to do those calculations yourself. Just to
help out.
But this is extremely significant since the real figures, not the nominal figures that really matter. The negative 2% on 10 years is where we were when Paul Volcker started his campaign against inflation in 1978-79. So we're just at the beginning, and people need to understand this. So when Powell began his war on inflation, he had to start at zero interest rates, zero. I mean, to go from zero to, you know, where he's headed, which has got to be 5 or 6% as the terminal rate at this point, based on the PCE services index, it's 5.7%. And you've got to get ahead of that, right? Well, we're still not in positive territory. Even
they're not fighting inflation. Yeah. It was Druckenmiller who said, you've never gone above 5% and rein back inflation without first getting ahead of the inflation rate in real terms. So they haven't begun to fight the inflation in spite of
begun.
It's still back to back 0.75s, which is already showing sign, and we're seeing banks breaking. So it's kind of, you're going to get killed. There's two walls, one with spikes and one with poison resin, and you're in this tapering wall, and you're just choosing your death as you're being on the conveyor belt moved forward. I don't see a way out. I was asked on a media appearance, and I just said there is no way out.
No, and
you just choose your death.
No, you can't, because here's the problem. From 2020 and 2021, the Federal Reserve created some $6.2 trillion 5.5% of that went or landed in the banking system, which were then invested in long-term treasuries at fixed rates, right? But this money, there is no way to really sop it up. I mean, it has to become endemic. I mean, like a virus, right? It has to become endemic. And the only way it becomes endemic is through price increases for assets, right? And I don't care if that expresses itself in terms of the stock market values or the price of eggs. The value of the dollar has got to decline to reach endemicity at some point, an equilibrium level, and we're just not there. The thing is that the Federal Reserve policy, as currently constituted, cannot do anything about reversing that history. All it can do is tighten credit markets now, yeah. You know, and that can what that actually does instead of stopping inflation is imposes a kind of recessionary environment. Which, yeah, if you can reduce velocity of money, will reduce price pressure too, but at the expense of economic growth.
Which is the hyperstagflation. You're either dying by death of demand or you're dying by inflation. You choose your poison again. Mm-hmm. So your expectation is a 2-5 basis points increase at the next meeting?
They have to. Unless Powell just lost his nerve. But how can he can't lose his nerve? Yeah. You've got to keep the campaign going. That's why, you know, he makes dovish signals from time to time and then acts like a hawk, you know? So we're gonna keep doing this for the foreseeable future until we reach that terminal rate. But you know what terminal rate looks like in terms of positive 10 years will be absolutely brutal to both the banking sector, the financial sector, and the industrial sector in this country, and not to mention the service on existing debt is going to grow and grow and grow. Cards, government debt, you know, being funded.
Subprime cars is one of the hottest at the moment with. I think Daniel DiMartino Bruce told me you can now get at the peak. It was 90 months payments to buy sort of 60% of a vehicle, a diminishing asset. That is such shotgun finance. You may as well just put, you know, the barrel right under your chin.
Oh, yeah.
It's unbelievable.
We're nowhere near out of this mess. I mean, it's a remarkable thing. And then at the same time, the Federal Reserve, don't forget, you've got the Fed on one hand, which is, you know, doesn't have a lot of power, but kind of a lot of power in terms of its manipulation of federal funds rates and so on. And some oversight of the banking industry. On the other hand, you have the Treasury Department, which is not the Federal Reserve. And the Treasury Department is promising dollar for dollar bailouts, regardless of FDIC insurance, for any bank that finds itself in trouble that poses a threat of systemic risk to the entire system. So you have two monetary policies operating at the same time. On one hand, you have a hawkish Federal Reserve right now, but a level of dovishness coming from the Treasury like we've never seen before. So, you know, probably those two aren't even on speaking terms at this point. But
as an ex-Fed chair as well, let's not forget, who's now a Democrat Treasury head. And surely a key point to take on, people need to realize it's a promise. It's not funded, the FIDIC system, to go that far. There will come a point when it's too big, it's too systemic, everybody all falls down. Ring a ring of roses. We all fall down, surely.
And it would have to take somebody more of an expert in this to say, but I don't know what happens when you've got a Federal Reserve balance sheet that's rising dramatically, as it is right now, to absorb all the expenditures associated with these bank bailouts. At the same time, you've got them tightening credit with a federal funds rate. So they're going the opposite direction in their balance sheet than they're going in terms of their policy. Like, I don't know the interaction between those two forces or what that looks like, but I do know they're contradictory, right? So this is not science. This is they're just making things up at this point, trying to to patch the system together with Scotch tape at this point.
Yeah. So taking it to the portfolio level and just thinking, let's just at a localized level, all these subprime cars, they're going to get repoed. They're going to have to get sold. Otherwise, they devalue. You'll end up with these you know, these desert ghosts where all the old Dakotas go to die if they don't sell them off. Surely the man with cash, and cash should be it's an important quartile to your portfolio for, you know, upgrading the car, getting some property when the interest rates spike, so much so that people that have overextended are being flushed out of homes. You could buy that dream home. The man who has not put the interest rate gun to his head and has got strong on cash, and can do, you know, 50% loan-to-value finance or outright purchases, surely stands to do some real bargain hunting in the next demand-destroying event that the future interest rates are going to bring down on our heads. Is talking portfolio, what's your comment?
I agree with that, but part of the problem is you don't know what the bargain is. So down is not necessarily the bargain. Even dramatically down is not necessarily the bargain. How much lower can you go? What, you know, how much lower are the prices of housing, real estate, office space, commercial office space? You know, how far is it going to fall before you get your buy signal? You know, this is what you don't know. And this is why, despite downward price pressure in many places of the country, not all, but in many, we don't know where the bottom really is. So it's very difficult to know exactly. I mean, so the bargain hunters out there are going to be finding a lot over the next six to eight months. But on the other hand, will they find themselves underwater in the subsequent 6 or 8 months?
and the key thing is that cash, where do you keep it? Because if you keep it in a bank and they get rinsed, you may have been the most prudent man only to face counterparty risk. You kind of need the Bitcoin and you need the gold, which brings us circle all the way back to where we started, in that these are the assets that people are holding trust on will still be there after whatever happens.
So what you have happening right now is a very big rush out of conventional commercial banking over to the financial companies, the non-bank banks, you know, the Merrill Lynch's and Fidelity's and Edward Jones's, which are perceived to be much safer, at least for now, than the banks. I think that's what accounts for the draining of bank reserves over the last week. Essentially, people, you know, and most people have maintained these two financial worlds for their liquid assets. You know, on one hand, they've got a Goldman Sachs account. On the other hand, they've got a Citibank account. So there you've seen a big migration out of the Citibanks into the Goldman Sachs's, right? But that's just for reasons of safety. It also might be the part of the intention on the part of the regulators and the big shots looking for a big monetary reform in the future to drain the conventional banking system ever more, certainly starting with the smaller banks, centralize the banks, get those all pumped into these non-bank banks, and then you're in a good position to impose, so they believe, something like a central bank a digital currency. So I that may be the game plan. I mean, it sounds a little too clever by half, but that seems to be what we're seeing. But that's just an intervening stage, right? So, but then what happens when the financial pressures and the uncertainties, you know, hit the new safe havens? You know, that's when people are going to be turning to gold and Bitcoin and to other sort of real assets. And none of us are prophets here, but every sign I'm seeing right now is that the storm is going to get a lot more severe. In fact, we might look back at the first half of 2023 as the salad days.
Mm. Yes, sad thought. But it could. I have the feeling that it's going to become a very, very rough second half of the year, and it's already leaning that way. What's your take on energy short term versus the longer term? We're kind of inflationary long term, but I see sudden dearth in economic activity potentially coming, and also indices, because the equities is the thing that confuses people. I'm good with miners and I'm good with the military industrial complex. They both seem to be doing exceedingly well. You have to hold your nose on the second one. But the general indices, in the stagflation environment, first a major liquidation as people dash for cash and they're being hit from every angle. And then afterwards, inflationary rises. Or are we going to get that 60s through to 70s churn because of hypervaluation? True, the beginning of the inflation that many people suspect. Yeah. And last decade.
I suspect that right now we're going to see inflation leave. Well, we've already seen inflation migrate out of goods to services, but I think it's going to be leaving services into financials. That's my best guess. And that's, I don't know how long that lasts, but it could last to the end of the year. So the inflation will express itself as you put it, hypervaluations. So that's for the near term. But eventually, of course, it comes and hits those two. But as I say, the $6.5 trillion, whatever it is, has to become endemic. And I don't know how far we are along that path. I mean, none of us are perfect.
What do you mean when you say endemic? That's 6 trillion. It has to be absorbed, or we have to see the full dilutionary effect as a result of that?
The full dilutionary effect, but also the way it affects prices can be unpredictable, right? So it's obvious in retrospect, just like a new virus, right? You don't know exactly how to get it, who's going to get it, where it's going to go next. You can look at the data and see, oh, that's what happened. But anticipating it in the future is a little bit unpredictable. So, it's been fascinating over the last 2 years to watch this inflation just sort of unfold, because it migrates out of one sector and then pops up in the next sector, and which one that is. I mean, I don't think anybody expected a year ago that eggs would be too expensive for kids to be able to paint for this Easter. Instead, they're having to paint potatoes. Okay, so that was something nobody expected last year, right? So that's the way it works. But the endemicity of these kind of mass inflationary events like we saw in 2020 and 2021 is inevitable in some way. And there will be no reverting back to the old price levels. I mean, that just is impossible. It's not going to happen.
This was the making of the Fed as well, with their transitory narrative, which they held off so long, which saw them get so far behind the curve that they've subsequently had to tighten so abruptly, which has caused this almost whiplash effect. Mm-hmm. A, they create too much money, and then they're taking it away too fast, or making it too expensive too fast. So it's about the central banking cartel, but how much has this most recent regime done to accelerate the demise here?
Powell made an enormous mistake. Back in 2019, he was already trying to unravel the zero interest rate policies. He's like, I mean, that guy, Powell hates Bernanke. He thinks he's an idiot. And so when he showed up at the Fed, he's like, we got to do something about this, the zero interest rate policies. This is dumb. It's massively distorting the production structures, which you learn from chapter one, series 65. I mean, we know that that's what happens, and he knew it. So he tried to unravel it, but then came the virus, and he got trolled into reversing his own policies and slamming the interest rates back down to the floor again. And then once he figured out that this whole thing that it was kind of a hoax, then he got mad, And I went back on his 2019 campaign. But in the meantime, it's not entirely clear if he understood what was going on. In the meantime, as I said, $5.5 trillion got pumped into the banking system. They had excess cash that they couldn't safely lend, so they had to store it somewhere. And the regulators were like, oh, you wonder where to put your money? You should put it in safe treasuries. Okay, Mr. Regulator, that's exactly what we'll do. Well, that worked until Powell changed policies and suddenly devalued the asset portfolios of every bank in the country. Now, the smart ones sold at a loss. Get rid of this shit. The dumb ones just kept changing their accounting structures and running fancier ads or whatever. Well, Some of those people got caught, but I'm telling you, there's a lot more out there that need to be caught. And the higher he raises rates, the more their portfolios are going to be denied. But again, there's no place for them to put their money. First of all, it's locked in treasuries at a fixed rate. That's a problem. So getting rid of them, they have to sell at a discount. Even if they could lend the money, but they can't. They cannot safely lend it without risking the fundamental liquidity disturbing the risk manager of their own lending operation. So they're stuck. So everybody's stuck with all this cash. They don't know what to do with it. They get screwed no matter what they do. Bad loans going out, as you say, subprime, or locking into treasuries that are going to be devalued next month. So there's nobody knows what to do with this.
Or putting it into a hypervalued stock market that could have a 30% crash. And
banks typically would not do that. I mean,
you're talking banks, yeah.
Yeah, that, and in fact, that sort of contradicts the regulatory priorities of the regime today. Because after 2008, they converted all the banks.
Stop speculating in stocks. That's really bad.
Okay. What should I do with the money? Oh, buy our debt. That's where it's really safe. So that's where all the regulators are going.
Yeah.
That turns out, under a regime of rising interest rates, to be the worst place you could have it.
Yeah.
So
yeah. And unfortunately, pension schemes fall into the same thing as banks, which means everybody who thinks they have a pension probably don't, on the basis that those assets could be completely worthless. There's such a proliferation of debt that you're going to get some UBI CBD substitute. I can't see any other way of dealing with that. In terms of pensions commitments, what's your take on people's pension commitments? And I think particularly, I know the US, you have 401k, so a lot of people might have bought individual stocks and equities, but in the UK, for example, they have these in life companies, and they are just stuffed with bonds. They've just been the bid side of government debt. And they say, yeah, we're smooth with profits, so they might put a small smattering in that risky stock market. But they're stuffed to the gills on bonds. Is there any other way that they will be serving or reneging on their alleged contract to the elderly after?
They will have to. I mean, you know, I mean, that's the beautiful thing about economics. It's got hard brick walls. I mean, you can't get through. And they mean something, you know. So all the dreaming of the world is not going to overcome the reality of the balance sheet. Yeah, the retirement portfolios and God knows pensions could be in grave trouble under a long-term, you know, stagflation. It's a tremendous mess. I mean, the long and short of it is that we're seeing the prosperity of the West that we've long taken for granted being unraveled systematically. I mean, on one hand, it's going slowly. On the other hand, it's like an unbelievably short period of time.
Yeah. We literally on that stage where it takes decades for small things to happen, and now you're getting in days, decades happening. We literally are getting those days. The disrespect that is being, everybody being emboldened to be disrespectful to America is actually part a concern for me. I'm happy to see the end of the central banking cabal and that sentiment, but actually, as a nation state, to have been the dominator, I'm not excited about the other nations that fill the void of America reduced.
I know exactly what you mean. You know, I mean, I spent my whole life sort of dreaming of the decline of the status of the state in terms of social, cultural, legal power, and so on. What we had not anticipated, it, at least speaking for myself, is that the decline of that power would also decline, you know, everything else, you know, with it. The discrediting of media, the discrediting of tech, of our health system, of the currency, and the implications for that for the future of prosperity. So the unraveling is not isolated to the things you don't like. It hits absolutely everything and transforms life itself and leads to a kind of stagnation in the U.S. like we've seen in Spain and France. You know, I mean, it's that seems to be what our future is, although it's going to be more spectacular, really, because, and I'm telling you, somebody else, America's not prepared for it, right? So we've got a whole generation, basically under the age of 60, who's never seen anything other than sort of onwards and upwards with a few glitches here and there. But you're talking about a long-term secular decline in the expectations, hopes, dreams, and experiences of the dominant part of the American population. They will not know what hit them.
Yeah. They've had it very good in the early half, and they get to have a real gritty, tough, scrapping second half. And I think, you know, we're going to see a lot of, you know, white American, white Westerner vagrants. You already have them, but I mean, on a far greater scale, that begging at traffic lights and this concept and families and children. I think there's going to be a sense of tragedy that I'm going to find really hard. Sure.
And what does this do to people politically? Does it make them libertarians? No, it makes them
populists.
Yeah.
Makes them wealthy. More welfare, please.
Yeah. More welfare. More. You know, you printed up trillions of dollars for the banking system. Now print up trillions of dollars for me.
So, they don't
have any clue about the limits of economics and the voting patterns. We got was going to. Reveal that. So we've got ostensibly a left and a right in this country, but it's not clear that there's any fundamental disagreement about, you know, the need to build Leviathan and expand the welfare state. I mean, they just want to do it in different ways. So that libertarian impulse that we associated with the Don't Tread on Me flag and all American patriotic songs, all that kind of stuff, is extinct in every form except, you know, the most superficial ones.
In fact, you have a close relationship and worked with Dr. Ron Paul. And I remember when he was running as a Republican candidate against Mitt Romney, how Mitt was saying, look, you ran a good campaign, time to step down now. And Ron kept running because he wanted the message to get through, and how it was embarrassing for the then Republican candidate, who essentially was a Trumpian, you know, he was not sound money orientated. And that was literally the last chance of America to choose a candidate who would have cut the spending like he would have done an Elon to Twitter. You know, he would have brought a lot of troops home instead of being in 150 countries. In the end, America's going to have to do that, because once your money's gone, you can't offer it to pay people in far off lands. They're not going to want to take it anymore. Yeah. So it's going to have to happen anyway, but now it's going to happen in humiliation, and it's going to be this empire contraction where everyone is literally chasing you out because there's nothing they want from you. You're no good at protecting them. They don't want your money. They want you owe them everything, and it's going to happen. If we had pivoted Ron Paul, I would have said he would have had a heck of a job, and he would have needed three or four terms to really turn the oil tanker around.
That's right.
We would have been a lot better off. What's your take on that?
The only thing I would say about that is that the person we call the president of the United States is not really in charge. We have the fourth branch of government is the single most powerful branch of government. It's called the administrative state. These are 2.5 million people with permanent jobs who are involved in regulating every aspect of government and civil society all across the board at all levels. We learned this during lockdown. They're the people who are really in charge, and everybody else is just a marionette. So a new president needs one priority, and it's unfortunately, it's you know, all the policies we can talk about are fine, except their influence is irrelevant so long as this administrative state survives. You can't.
No, I'm not for voting for that very reason. They are teleprompter readers. They have a stylistic sense. They're the media face. But in truth, this direction is managed by a darker state than that.
So, you know, an actual, like in his fantasy, right? But if Ron Paul becomes president or somebody like him, there should be one job, and it'll consume the better part of 4 years, which is to dismantle the machine or the administration. Until that happens, all the rest of your policy dreams are irrelevant.
Well, smashed.
They will always
In a hypothetical scenario that he, in his first term, dismantled 2.5 million bureaucrats that were hell-bent on this long-term journey, which was this perversion, this inversion perversion with the transgender, the entire caboodle, the cultural wars that they were perpetuating on us, the hoax you mentioned, which I won't delve on too much for YouTube, but et cetera, et cetera. And we got some sincerity, some element of integrity and sincerity back in there. And he took 4 years to do it. And he was afforded two or three more terms on the back. Very hypothetical. America could have turned the oil tanker around under his guise if he brought people bought into his principles into those governmental positions.
Well, I have to say,
permanent government.
Even from my point of view, I don't think I realized until the last couple of years the sheer power and reach and influence of the administrative state. Like that has been a shock to me. And unless anybody who doesn't understand does not understand the real world of politics today.
Yeah.
So everything else is just a talking point. That's what I've learned. And
March 2020 and the events of that period have certainly shown us that, wow, there were some extremely powerful forces, because we saw Hollywood stars, sitcom stars weaponized into this. I saw Arnold Schwarzenegger, him of the Terminator, sharing his views on your freedoms and what you should be doing. And wow, I don't want to over delve in it for YouTube, but we just saw that there's on every level they were popping up, and they were being orchestrated and being brought to the fore.
Nobody bothered to talk to the legislatures, right? I mean, their job of Congress was just to vote for the big spending bills, which they did over Zoom, you know. But apart from that, they weren't directing anything. So the elected leaders in this country and in many countries around the world were basically irrelevant. They're just having to defer to the managerial elite in the public sector who ran everything at the behest of very, very powerful interests. And that's the real world of government today. I mean, it has nothing to do with the dreams of Thomas Paine or that generation of thinkers. You know, this is not Republican forms of government as we understood it for the last 300 years. This is something different. It's something much more brutal and at once ancient, on the other hand, highly technocratic, right? So they're trying to impose a kind of a system that I don't think anybody would favor, any normal person would favor, which is, you know, a ruling class elite making all the decisions for the rest of the population according to their vision of what's right for us. And that's it. And they don't want anybody, any disagreement. And they won't tolerate the courts that try to restrain them. The only possible effect we can have on them is public opinion. But unfortunately, these days, public opinion is not very reliable because of the demoralization of the population following the last 3 years is complete, you know? We talked about
and they manage the media so well that actually if you have the right reaction at public opinion level, you've meant to felt like a minority and are totally gaslit into fearing to even express those views for want of being far right. It was Zuby, who is for those who don't know him on Twitter, is a black African American, I think, or rapper, actually was in Britain as well, that said, since when did questioning medical science make you a far right Nazi, you know, and it was ironic coming, you know, from him as well. It just seems the stigmatization has been brutally effective in terms of anybody who questions this permanent state. And I wanted to mention, if you're in the UK and watching this, it's regularly referred to as Whitehall. Those are the unelected bureaucrats. And America has its own version of Whitehall as you mentioned. So it's funny that the media has been such a big role player in masking this, and it's also taken our eye off the failure of the central banking cartel and the financial system. It's been really ironic. You'll love this bit of FUD from Bailey. He was saying, inflation is here. This is Bailey, as the central bank head of Bank of England. His recent excuse was that people are retiring early. Their life is so good, and that's why there's inflation, because we have to pay higher wages for these skill sets that have all elected to retire early. So we're getting all of these amazing narratives as to why their proliferation activities during the events of March 2020 have led to loss of currency buying power and inflation.
Yeah, the excuses are just, well, I mean, even the Fed itself refuses to take any responsibility for the inflation that they themselves generated. Like, you have to be a complete idiot not to see the relationship between the central bank policies and the inflation. But boy, they will never admit it, you know? Even Powell claims that it was distortion of production structures because of lockdowns and supply chain breakages, you know, leading to shortages here and there. And there's, he has every possible excuse, except none of which are related to his own policies. So they're not taking any responsibility for anything, which is a real tragedy. I mean, like when March 2020 began, I thought, oh, these people are going to have to fess up at their great errors, and it's only a matter of days, then weeks, then months, now years, and they're still not admitting it, right?
Yeah, I mean, we're both in a group, and people have been commenting, yes, there's pushback now, and look at Paris and all of that. And I say, no, they're winning. Until you've rounded up all the people behind the March 2020 events, and you've actually literally had public hangings or beheadings or full-scale courts with massive names that you never thought would happen and closure of companies, you haven't had the justice and the reaction for what was perpetuated upon us, and you aren't winning. You're just being given morale-boosting bones to think that somebody's out there fighting for you, and it's part of a controlled opposition that gives you a fake hope for a while, and then it's quickly snuffed out.
Well, you know, you have to ask yourself, where were the courts when we needed them? They weren't there. So why would they be there for us now?
Exactly. What should people do in wrapping? Portfolio-wise, how? I mean, I'm expecting Bitcoin to play a role in this. How should people protect? And is there anything else socially and activity-wise, the outside of just the money element, that you would recommend? The Jeffrey Tucker five-bullet plan to surviving the Great Reset and the introduction of PPI and CBDCs. Well,
I would say right now, debt is a really bad idea. Now, I say that because a lot of people think that debt is a good idea in inflationary times, so you pay it back in the end. But actually, that is very dangerous right now because it limits your financial options and limits your ability to move professionally. It's a really good time. We have a calm before the storm right now to make sure that you're as independent as possible and you're able to move, for example, whether it's, you know, out of the country or across the country or somewhere. So if you're trapped in jobs, it's like, you know, it's a good time to kind of consider other options. That's like really important. Like, yeah. if you've got a flow you've got to depend on, then make sure that's good, because just like I say, there's going to be euthanasia in the overclass, and you don't want to be among them. Socially and culturally, these are very difficult times for people. Very difficult. I mean, our lives have been shattered. Our friend circles have changed. I mean, a lot of people have lost friends. You just realize that things are not going back to the way they were. And we have to cobble together a life for ourselves right now. And there's no sense in being despairing or being demoralized about it. Just get strong and prepare yourself. It's also, I would say, a good time to start worrying about your health. They don't care about your health, so you should. The diet and exercise, and I mean that seriously, not just in cliche, but like get serious about what goes in your mouth and stop letting them control you. Because you can't depend on the medical establishment anymore. In fact, it's actively dangerous to be embroiled in them. And that's a really important, I think that's already point four. So I don't know what I would say about, point five, for God's sake, release yourself by the control from the mainstream media. I mean, that is a disaster.
Yeah.
Like, we've got a lot of independent media going on today, and that's the only place you're going to find out any really serious insight.
Including yourself. Please mention the Epoch Times and how people can find you in that, Jeff.
Right. Look, it's not an expensive subscription. People complain. They're like, oh, it's behind a paywall. Well, screw you. They've got a business model. and it's working. It's the fourth largest newspaper in the English-speaking language now. So a great deal of influence. I write for them every single day. My own research institute is called Brownstone, and we're doing great work. We have a tiny staff, but a very, very big impact. I've lost faith in all big institutions, and I have no interest in creating one, right? So our scaling up looks like doing more charitable work, essentially. You know, like we're very involved in rescuing professional careers from people displaced in these upheaval times, and we need a lot more resources. We're doing very well. We have 9 fellows. And by the way, we have a million faithful readers, so a great deal of influence, again, with a very small staff. So I think that's where you have to be in the future. You have to be agile and be sincere and be truthful. And then I think you can and be wise. And then
I remember Sting saying about the Police, his original band, you know, was a 3-piece band. There's no passengers in a 3-piece band. And everybody rows in that boat. And in a sense, you want that business where there's everybody is dealing with either a content creator or if you're a content business or a content, you know, uploader, tweaker, editor. There is no, as you said, there's no middle management to be cut out. There's no in-betweeners and intermediaries. You're all doing coalface activity. You're the front man and you're the speaker and author. The others are get booking your diary and doing things directly related to doing that. I love that. So there you have it, Jeffrey Tucker. It's been absolutely awesome. I'd love to do this again sometime in a couple of months' time. Thank you for your tips. Let's watch this world go on its weary way. I think I'd summarize your one of the things you said, look within, because you can't control what's out. Look within and work on that. High mental state. Light. I've quit coffee, alcohol, all forms of things that toxify me. I've just gone with Sadhguru, who says, be in a perpetual state of ecstatic joy. And I'm just loving every moment, and I'm making sure I'm going outdoors every day, nature every day, sand between your toes every day, swim in the sea, live the life to your fullest. And I think you'll keep win the mind game, because this is a mental psyop that you are facing as much as it is a financial destruction.
I agree with everything you just said. Yeah.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on. And I look forward to putting this out. And just one more time, where do people find your website?
Brownstone.org.
Brownstone.org.
Is where I live.
And every day writing on the Epoch Times, get a subscription. You know you need it. Excellent. Thanks so much, Jeffrey. Have a great day.
Pleasure. Thank you.
Bye-bye.